This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes in our midst. There are men and women right around you who've done incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and many times inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case today, because if you just met this man, you'd be impressed. 96 years old, doesn't look like it, doesn't sound like it. And I imagine you get that reaction sometime. Augustine Chavez of Visalia, California, our guest. So, Augie, how often do you have people say, no, you're not 96 years old?
Quite often.
Do you have a good line, a good comeback for them when they ask you something like that?
Yes, I tell them that I was obedient to my father and mother. That's why the Lord blessed me with such a long life.
I like that answer. Well, speaking of your father and mother, let's go back to your early days growing up in a neat part of the San Joaquin Valley, right up against the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, Woodlake, California. What was it like growing up in Woodlake in the 1930s?
Well, it was at the height of the Depression. We were very poor, but there was a lot of family-like. We stuck together. We had a lot of cohesion. And we went to church, especially on Sundays. I went to Sunday school, and I got my first award when I was 7 years old in the Presbyterian Church for learning the names of the books of the Bible, Old and New Testament.
At 7 years old, I like that, in Woodlake, California. And we're going to find out about your World War II service in the 40th Infantry Division and the different things you experienced in the Pacific. But you mentioned the Depression years there in Woodlake. You had a couple brothers. You had three sisters. What'd you guys do to keep yourselves occupied out there? I imagine there were no shortage of adventures.
Well, after school, we had chores to do. No one had to tell us to gather wood and chop wood and milk a cow. I got half of the milk, raw milk, and ride horses, and had a lot of good outdoor exercise. I herded cattle, at least 50 cows, two, three times a week for my brother-in-law, who was a cattleman and had a meat market and slaughterhouse and grazing cattle up in Dry Creek.
And at Woodlake High School, I know you were part of the class of 1936. Were you into sports at all? Was that a big deal? I know Woodlake, years later, had become famous for its football program with the great Leo Robinson out there. But were you an athlete in high school?
I never was physical enough to be an athlete in the big sports. However, under those conditions, I took up swimming and diving, and I became pretty expert at it.
And people might figure out with your age at 96 that maybe you got into the service before America was drawn into World War II. And I know that is indeed the case. So how was it that you decided to join the Army?
Well, quite a few of my friends were in the National Guards. And I wanted to get a little excitement out of life because, like I say, everyone was so poor that we were lucky to get out to Larry County once in a while. So I joined the National Guards, and we went on maneuvers. We had our coat of arms even before war was declared and everything. And then henceforth, we trained draftees from Camp Roberts and Camp Walters, Texas.
I know you've got a pretty good story about where you were on December 7th and how you found out about all that. But take me back if you can. I know you've got a really good memory. So do you remember what you were thinking before that happened? Did you expect, do you think, war to break out? Were you kind of anticipating what was going to happen?
Well, I wasn't intellectually inclined at that time, but the handwriting was on the wall. You know, it first they said that the extension of the service and plus 6 months, but that didn't come true. Of course, I was pretty young to have the perspective of advanced thinking like that. So when Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was in an extended weekend pass. So my dad woke me up and says, put your uniform on and head for San Luis Obispo.
So you're back here in Woodlake with your family, and your dad hears over the radio, and you got to get it in gear. Did that how did that play out in your mind? Was that exciting? Did it make you a little nervous and concerned? What do you remember about that?
Well, it was an era of patriotism, and everybody wanted to do their duty. So consequently, I wasn't scared or anything. I knew that the Lord would have his right hand on me continuously, and I just took off. We loaded ammunition for 2 days and two nights, and then we headed for Los Angeles to set up installations around the coast.
And I've talked to a lot of folks who were at different parts of the California coast during that time, the immediate aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack. And a lot of them have described the, I wouldn't call it panic, but great concern that Japanese planes and ships might be showing up on the California coast. Were you at all concerned about that? Did you catch any of that kind of buzz?
Well, in the books that I had read, I wasn't quite surprised because I studied Homer Lee, who was expelled from Stanford University at the turn of the 20th century for making statements like the possibility of Pearl Harbor being bombed 45 years before it happened. And on the strength of that, I was a little perturbed, but it did come really a surprise to me because when he wrote The Valor of Ignorance, this is just a marvelous book, he got expelled for making statements like the possibility of Pearl Harbor being bombed 40 years before it happened. And he was brokenhearted, so he went to China during the Boxer Rebellion and became the finest military strategist of that era. His teachings were compulsory in the Japanese, Russian, German army, optional at West Point.
Yeah, so you had a clue of what was going on in the world. Were you eager to get involved somewhere and to see America rise from those ashes of Pearl Harbor? Was that a little nerve-wracking for you to consider that possibility?
We didn't have time to think because things were happening so fast, you know, that that we just didn't have time to worry about like that. We all were ready to do our duty, and we knew that it wasn't going to be fun, but we left it in God's hands.
And as it turned out, both of your brothers would end up in the service as well. Were you able to keep tabs on them during World War II?
A little bit. My one brother was in the hospital ship, made trips back and forth from France and England, bringing wounded. And my other brother was in finance. He had 2 years of college, so he went up pretty fast in the Air Force.
And let's talk about your experience. So you'd been in before the war, so you'd been through that toughen you up kind of period, the break you into the Army. How soon did you actually get deployed, and what can you share about your first taste of combat?
Well, when we left Los Angeles, we got extensive training in Fort Lewis, Washington for 4 months, and then we went to the Hawaiian Islands for 8 months and done jungle training and trained also recruits. We knew that sooner or later we were going to confront the enemy. So in August of 1943, we relieved the 1st Marines in Guadalcanal, and that was our first taste of action.
And you don't just press a button and end up at Guadalcanal. You had some ocean to cover to get there. I'm just curious, as a boy who grew up in the San Joaquin Valley, had you ever been on a ship before? And what was that journey to Guadalcanal like for you?
The first time I was on a ship was 2,500 of us on the President Johnson. And we went to the Hawaiian Islands. It took us about 3 or 4 days to get there. Well, that was it. We trained. We were ready. We knew that we're going to confront the enemy sooner or later. And we didn't have time to worry about like that, things like that.
So this is with the 40th Infantry Division that you arrive at Guadalcanal. The Marines have been fighting there to secure that island. And what were your specific duties in your unit?
Well, my specific duties at that time, I was a corporal and I was squad leader. And my duties were to teach my my squad the intricate phases of the guns that we handled and the different fires and how to confront the enemy on certain situations. However, and then as I became a sergeant, I'd done quite a bit of lecturing in machine guns and the intricate phases of Dash-21, Dash-21-55, Dash-21-100. But in the field of battle, there's no time to check the field manual. It's common sense, imagination, and guts, which was the American soldier has always been famous for, and you function on reflexes.
Well, I think you're whetting all of our appetites to hear some of the stories of where you had to do that. But as far as Guadalcanal was concerned, what greeted you when you got there? What are some of the images and situations that you can still remember all these years later?
Well, primarily there was no water, and the water finally that we got tasted like gasoline. It was raining cats and dogs. I mean, really raining hard. And the first few days, some training for the front lines, and we knew that we were going to relieve the enemy real soon, and we were prepared for that. However, most of the fighting had already been done by the Marines, and we cleaned up.
And you say that you cleaned up, and you know what that means, and you lived it. But for those of us who weren't there, can you help us understand what that meant? And as a relatively young man, I mean, you're, I guess, 25 years old by this point, I imagine you were seeing things that you'd never seen before and that you didn't really want to see. Was it hard to kind of take in that destruction and devastation and the loss of life?
Well, you don't have time to worry about getting killed. Like I say, you function on reflexes, and you have a duty to do, and all you want to do is stay alive as much as you can and protect your squads and the men that you're in charge of. Well, that's it. We stayed there in Guadalcanal until we completely cleaned the island. In confronting the enemy, by that time they were on defense, and we were doing the advancing. And from there on, we got ready to another invasion in New Britain. We were the first troops there.
Well, I want to hear about that, and kind of a side note that I'm thinking of as we're discussing this. Now, your heritage is French and Spanish and Native American. I'm sure there are other soldiers who saw your last name, and they knew that you were some kind of minority, so to speak, that maybe they thought you were Mexican. I've talked to some Hispanic soldiers or Latino veterans who encountered some ribbing or... some of them have called it racist behavior that was employed against them. Did you ever have any kind of issues with any of the other soldiers that you served with, or how did they embrace you?
No prejudice at all. Predominantly, our replacements were from New York and the Midwest, and they were amazed, most of them, at the kind of English that we spoke. Of course, I was fortunate enough to, with the Mexican fellows of Mexican heritage that were in Company D, they came from families that always spoke English at home. And I was brought up in a town in Woodlake where there was no prejudice. And I was very fortunate. I went to Sunday school. I went with the Anglo kids, and they treated me just wonderful. Of course, I was a little vain, and I made up my mind, like my dad said, always study and rub elbows with people that know more than you do, because how can you edify yourself if you run around with people that know less than you do? And by the writings and the reading that I done and the knowledge that I acquired as a very young man, the Anglo kids were amazed that I knew more about things of our government than they did.
Well, I think anybody listening right now is getting an idea of how they felt. You mentioned New Britain. That's a long way from Great Britain. Tell us where New Britain was and what you were doing there.
Well, it was part of the British archipelago, you know, along with Guadalcanal, New Guinea, and all that. There was quite a few Japanese troops there, but not as many as we thought we would be. The resistance wasn't that great, but still many of us got killed. Our big resistance came when we were the first troops in the first wave in Luzon, in the Philippines.
And we'll get to that. I'm curious, and you just made reference to people getting killed. Do you remember the first time that somebody you actually knew or had spent a lot of time with or had drawn close to was killed in action, and what that meant to you, how you responded to that?
Well, many of the fellows that I knew real well got killed. In fact, we were on the advance one time, and DG, we used to call him DiGeronimo, just about 20 feet from me, stepped on a mine, and his body just blew all every direction. And I just kept going. I didn't want to look back. But later on in my foxhole, I couldn't help but get the shakes. And many others that I wasn't very close to got killed. But it's quite an experience. It's no fun talking about it.
No, and I'm not trying to put you in a place that's not comfortable or that's painful, but it sure does help us to understand what you've been through, so we don't take things for granted. And I just hear you talking now, and you seem so comfortable and confident and sure of who you are. In those moments, I'm sure there are a lot of things that go through your mind if you're in that foxhole and your buddies have been killed that day, whether it's by a sniper's bullet or a machine gun or a mine like that. Isn't there part of you that says, that could be me tomorrow? And how do you deal with that?
Well, like I say, you function on reflex. There's no doubt that you can understand that you're scared, but you're not a coward, because your buddies are doing the same you're doing, and you want them to be proud of you, and they felt the same way afterwards when I speak to them, that that they were only up there because they had a lot of company.
That is a great point. The strength in numbers, that inspiration provided by others putting their lives on the line, and that's what Augie Chavez did in World War II. He's still going strong at 96. In fact, he still sings in a band, and I'm going to try to get him to sing for us before we're done. Time for a break, but we'll go back to the jungles of the Pacific with this veteran of the 40th Infantry Division and find out how he earned the Bronze Star. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.